This is the second of a three-part series entitled Covenant, the Story of a Biblical Pattern. Those who were here yesterday recall that I introduced you to the understanding of covenant in the Hebrew Scriptures, in the Old Testament. I discussed with you three texts. The first one related to the covenant between David and Jonathan, as we find it described in 1 Samuel 18. The second text related to Jacob and Laban and the covenant they concluded with each other that was to bind both them and their descendants in Genesis chapter 31. And then finally I discussed with you Genesis 15, 7 following, the story of the covenant that God made with Abraham. And you recall that we concluded that covenants were made, at least so we judge on the basis of these texts from the Old Testament, when the situation in which the covenant partners to be found themselves was insecure, uncertain, that the covenant into which they entered made their relationship secure, created a space for them within which to live, and related them in mutuality to each other. These were the main points we made in response to one question at the end. We also noted that in the Old Testament we find covenants that are made between equal partners, usually human partners, and covenants that are made between God and Israel. In that case, we would have to speak of an unequal covenant relationship. I pointed out to you that there is one book in the Old Testament, the book of Deuteronomy, where covenant has become the basic idea of a whole theological system. It is written, so to speak, with a capital C there. Now, all this needs much more explanation, and so I would like to round out my presentation yesterday and at the same time lead over to what I would like to present today by reading with you a text from the second book of Kings. 2 Kings 23, 1 through 3. 2 Kings 23, 1 through 3. Let me fill you in on the context. This is toward the end of the historical books, or more exactly of the books of the Kings. We come here very close to the period of the famous Babylonian exile. To be quite exact, the text 2 Kings 23 can be dated to the year 621 BCE, or according to some, 622 BCE, a generation before the exile. We do know from this text, and what is written in several chapters in this part of the books of Kings, that at that time a reformation took place in ancient Israel. It is the famous reform of King Josiah. We hear quite a bit about this. This particular text tells us about what seems to have been the most important feature of this reform or reformation of King Josiah in the year 621. Let me read it to you according to the translation of the New English Bible. Then the king sent and called all the elders of Judah and Jerusalem together. The then, at the beginning of the sentence, refers to this particular situation, namely when the priests had found the Book of the Covenant in the temple, when they were repairing the temple. That book had been read by the king, and this is now one of his reactions to this finding of the Book of the Covenant. The king sent and called all the elders of Judah and Jerusalem together and went up to the house of the Lord. He took with him the men of Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the priests and the prophets, the whole population, high and low. There he read out to them all the book of the covenant discovered in the house of the Lord. And then, standing by the pillar, the king made a covenant before the Lord to obey him and keep his commandments, his testimonies, and his statutes with all his heart and soul, and so fulfill the terms of the covenant written in this book. And all the people pledged themselves to the covenant. Now here you have one of those passages in the Old Testament that is most important for any understanding of the biblical notion of the covenant. To be sure, it refers to a certain historical occasion when the people of Israel were, through their king, initiated or re-initiated into the covenant relationship between God and his people. All this has to be seen in the context of the famous reform of King Josiah. In fact, this introduction of a covenantal pattern, conscious introduction of a covenantal pattern into the whole relationship between God and his people, was the mark of the reform of King Josiah. Now, much more could be said about this particular reform. One thing, though, must be mentioned here. Scholars have wondered through the ages, already some of the church fathers, by the way, have wondered what gave impetus, what initiated this reform movement. Not so much the actual historical circumstances, they are fairly clear, but what sort of religious dynamic, what force caused all this to surface in such a strong way? Well, and here already some of the church fathers made a very simple observation and came to a very simple thesis. The ethos, the spirit of this reform movement that caused this covenant to be concluded, is really very well described in the book of Deuteronomy. And so St. Jerome, for instance, one of the church fathers, a Bible scholar of no mean standing, suggested that it was the book of the covenant, namely the book of Deuteronomy, found in the temple, that stood behind the reform of King Josiah. Now, you may wonder why I lay out all this so much in detail. I lay it out because in the book of Deuteronomy, you have developed a very consistent theology of the covenant. If I were to sketch it in my own words, pulling together what you find in the book of Deuteronomy, evidently standing behind this reform described in 2 Kings, I would have to say it is really a great concentration, a bringing together of all of Israel's tradition and presence into one guiding notion, that of God's covenant with his people. More, this covenant that God makes with his people is a very centered one. Centered in the sense that he, the one God of Israel, hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one, Deuteronomy 6, that the one God of Israel calls, elects of old his one people Israel. Never mind the 12 tribes, we always hear of the one people Israel. He binds this one people to him, the one God of this people, so that they might respond to him in single-minded loyalty and gratefulness. This is what is spelled out time and again in the book of Deuteronomy. They are to live on the one land, the one inheritance he has given to them of old, has promised already to their fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. There they are to live. They are to worship at the one holy place that God chooses, very heavily emphasized in Deuteronomy, especially chapter 12. There where God lets his name dwell, the temple in Jerusalem, presumably. They are to be guided by the one prophet whom God will raise up from among them in the image of the greatest prophet of them all, in the image of Moses. That's what you read in Deuteronomy 18. So you could unfold this covenantal theology that you encounter in the book of Deuteronomy and which stood behind Josiah's reform through the numeral one. The one God of Israel chooses his one people out of many nations, so that on the one land they might serve him in single-minded loyalty, centered in worship at the one place that he chooses, guided by the one prophet which he from time to time raises up from among them. They are not to be like the many nations around them. They were really selected out of them. They do not have, like the nations around them, many gods,
they have only one God, one holy place, one prophet, one land. This is the most impressive theology in the technical sense of the term that I know of in the Old Testament. It could be compared to the systematic strength of the letter to the Romans in the New Testament. I have also laid it out for you in some detail because it was from then on to shape the thinking and the belief of ancient Israel. We encounter this Deuteronomic covenant theology time and again when we read the later voices in the Old Testament, those that speak to us from the dark days of the exile, those that speak to us from the first days after the exile, when they reconstituted themselves as a congregation around the rebuilt temple. We encounter it in the latest Old Testament writings. We encounter it in the intertestamental writings, in Ben Sira, for instance, or in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And of course, we encounter it in the New Testament, when Jesus can summarize the law by referring first of all to the most basic text in the book of Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy 6:4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one Lord. And we encounter it time and again in the belief, in the prayer, and in the thought of both the synagogue and the church. Now that, so to speak, rounds out my presentation of yesterday, and at the same time leads over to what is the emphasis of my presentation today. We not only hear a lot about the covenant in the scriptures, we hear also quite a bit about the covenant qualified as an eternal covenant. Just as we hear also, especially in the New Testament, but also in some later Jewish writing, about the covenant qualified as the new covenant. And so, you recall, today I would like to discuss with you the covenant as an eternal covenant. Tomorrow I would like to discuss with you the covenant as the new covenant. Now, what is the story behind qualifying, describing the covenant as an eternal covenant? You have not heard me refer to it in the presentations up to now as an eternal covenant. I just spoke of the covenant. Why this emphasis on the eternal quality of the covenant? Now, to be sure, we find this emphasis not always. We find it at certain times and in certain writings of the Old Testament. We find it in writings that come from the period of the exile. Now, I'm sure you remember from Sunday school days or college courses or what have you, that the Babylonian exile that came over the Israelites in the 6th century, to be exact, from 597, 87, there were actually two exiles, down to 538, you recall that these were the darkest days of ancient Israel. As such, they were remembered. We have moving testimony to that in some of the Psalms. Psalm 137. By the willow trees of Babylon, there we sat down and wept, so the exile said. Our tormentors made fun of us, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. Not only injury, but also insult. How can we sing one of the songs of Zion in a foreign land? Or you can read the book of Lamentations that follows the book of Jeremiah for a very full and moving description of the misery, the disaster that had come over them. Or you may turn to Psalm 73, where a psalmist deplores the destruction of the temple and describes in great detail how the Babylonian armies have moved in with axes and cut everything to pieces and then burned the holy place and the city and the palace to boot. So you are not surprised to hear from the Babylonian exile voices of despair. These, however, are not the only voices we hear during the time of the Babylonian exile. There are other voices that say, true, the disaster that has struck us is great. We have fallen very deep. Does this mean that we have to give up the traditions of our fathers, that we no more stand in the faith of ancient Israel, that the God of Israel is now for us a matter of the past, that a new day has dawned, we have to make a new beginning, we have to become, so some said, like the nations, we have to become Gentiles. Others said, no, what God has once begun, that he will not end. The covenant he once made is really an eternal covenant. And now we find in that part of the Old Testament, especially scattered through the first books of the Old Testament, which comes from priestly writers, priestly theologians, who spoke during the Babylonian exile, a covenant theology that is much more fully developed still than the covenant theology of the book of Deuteronomy that had been spoken and thought out two generations earlier. It is a very comprehensive covenant theology, and it is a theology that emphasizes the eternity of God's covenantal grant of old. But now let me come to some texts that illustrate that very well. Those that I would like to read with you are found here on the blackboard, Genesis 9, 12 through 17, Genesis 17, 9 through 14, and Exodus 31, 12 through 17. These three texts belong closely together. They all were formulated by priestly theologians during the time of the exile, and they develop a very comprehensive understanding of the covenant. They say there is not just one covenant, but there are three covenants, and these three covenants succeed each other. You could speak of covenant dispensations. And you know that in the history of the church and the synagogue, there have been groups that were great in developing dispensational theology. Ultimately, it goes back to this scheme developed by priestly theologians. There is not one covenant, but there are three covenants, and they are related to each other in terms of succession. There is first the covenant with Noah and his descendants, then the covenant with Abraham and his descendants, and finally the covenant through Moses with Israel and Israel only. A succession of covenants. More, the first covenant is the most inclusive and comprehensive one, that with Noah and his descendants. That, after all, includes everybody, every human being, and actually the beasts and the animals also. The covenant with Abraham does not annul, throw out the earlier covenant, but stands in the center of it. If you were to use a diagram, it would look like this. The most comprehensive covenant is that with Noah, Genesis 9, and his descendants. Then there is a covenant relationship that singles out from all of Noah's descendants, all human beings, just those of Abraham and his descendants, which would include the Arabs, by the way, Genesis 17. And then we have, in the center of it all, the covenant relationship that God has only with Israel, given at Mount Sinai through Moses. And here the best passage to study this is Exodus 31, 12 through 17. So you see, there is a lot of system of thinking in this. Actually, I can illustrate this in further ways. In each of the covenant grantings, a sign is given. You could almost think of a sacrament that confirms it. The sign of the covenant that is given to Noah and his descendants, you know it, is the rainbow. It is a sign that can be seen any time God puts the rainbow there. You simply observe it and you take your assurance from it. The sign that is given to Abraham and his descendants of the covenant with him is that of circumcision. Again, this is a sacramental sign, but one to be carried out actively. Then, the most central covenant relationship also has a sign. Its sign is the Sabbath, or the observance of the Sabbath.
again, so to speak, a sacrament about to be carried out not just once as this one, but week by week. Or I can play it another way. God makes himself known to Noah by his most general name, by which name he is known everywhere, God. To Abraham, however, he makes himself known in a more intimate way as God Almighty. Actually, this translation covers up somewhat the quality of the Hebrew, because in Hebrew you have a name given that is very difficult to translate. God Almighty is a very old translation that generalizes unduly. Here he makes himself known more intimately through the name El Shaddai. He makes himself most intimately known to Israel through Moses by letting them know his own proper name. Yahweh, so at least many people think that ancient name of God is to be pronounced, commonly transliterated capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. And that's the way in which you find it in the New English Version and in the Revised Standard Version. So you have three covenantal signs, you have three stages of the revelation of the divine, and you have several other passages, for instance, in the sixth chapter of the book of Exodus, where this is very neatly laid out, even though in somewhat different words and terms. Now, this very systematic understanding of the covenant that is laid out by priestly theologians during the time of the exile excludes really nobody. Remember, I pointed to that problem in the covenantal pattern, that it creates an in-group and an out-group, that it has an inclusive and an exclusive quality to it. These priestly theologians try to bridge this tension and to make covenant both inclusive and exclusive by having it understood in three concentric circles. This covenantal pattern, by the way, was then to become the heritage of the church and the synagogue, and I think it would be interesting to discuss Paul's understanding of the relation between Israel and the nations in terms of this diagram. But that is not our task at this point. Now, this is the setting of these three passages that I would like to read with you now. Let me turn to the first one, Genesis chapter 9, which is the epilogue, the postscript of these priestly theologians to their story of the great flood. And they assure all who care to listen that the great flood shall not come again. On the contrary, God makes a covenant unto life with all creation. God said, this is the sign of the covenant. Remember what I said about sign? You could almost translate it with the Christian term sacrament. This is the sign of the covenant which I establish between myself and you and every living creature with you to endless generations. I will come back to this word endless in a moment. My bow I set into the cloud, sign of the rainbow. Of the covenant, sorry, between myself and the earth. When I cloud the sky over the earth, the bow shall be seen in the cloud. Then will I remember the covenant which I made between myself and you and living things of every kind. Never again shall the waters become a flood to destroy all living creatures. The rainbow shall be in the cloud. When I see it, it will remind me of the everlasting covenant. God also uses his sacramental sign to remind himself. I think that's a neat little point here. It will remind me of the everlasting covenant between God and the living things on earth of every kind. God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant which I make between myself and all that lives on earth. Now what I have read here is simply the passage that backs up my earlier interpretation that is symbolized in the diagram by this most inclusive circle. But what I would like to stress at this point is that our priestly theologians put very heavy emphasis on the fact that this covenant is to be, quote, to endless generations, is to be a covenant on and on, forever, or in other translations, an eternal covenant. Let's keep that in mind as we turn to the second passage, Genesis 17, 9 through 14. Again, from our priestly theologians,
who here put it as an epilogue to their story of Abraham's covenant with God. God said to Abraham, "For your part, you must keep my covenant, you and your descendants after you, generation by generation." You note how in different ways the eternal quality of the covenant is stressed. "This is how you shall keep my covenant between myself and your descendants after you. Circumcise yourselves, every male among you. You shall circumcise the flesh of your foreskin, and it shall be the sign of the covenant between us." You see, again that technical term, the sign of the covenant, corresponds to a technical Hebrew term that we well know. "Every male among you in every generation shall be circumcised on the eighth day, both those born in your house and any foreigner, not of your blood, but bought with your money. Circumcise both those born in your house and those bought with your money. Thus shall my covenant be marked in your flesh as an everlasting covenant. Every uncircumcised male, everyone who has not had the flesh of his foreskin circumcised, shall be cut off from the kin of his father. He has broken my covenant." And now let me turn to the last passage I would like to discuss with you in this context, Exodus 31, 12 through 17. The context here is Israel at Mount Sinai. And now Moses is the covenant mediator of the most intimate covenant relationship in which God makes even known his own name, the Lord of Israel. "The Lord spoke to Moses and said, 'Speak to the Israelites, you yourself, and say to them, above all, you shall observe my Sabbath. For the Sabbath is a sign.'" Here again you have that technical term of these priestly theologians who speak to us. "Between me and you in every generation, that you may know that I am the Lord who hallows you. You shall keep the Sabbath because it is a holy day for you. If anyone profanes it, he must be put to death. Anyone who does work on it shall be cut off from his father's skin. Work may be done on 6 days, but on the seventh day there is a Sabbath of sacred rest, holy to the Lord. The Israelites shall keep the Sabbath. They shall keep it in every generation as a covenant forever. It is a sign forever between me and the Israelites. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, but on the seventh day he ceased work and refreshed himself." Well, it really is rubbed in, is it not? That the covenant is something eternal. That is said time and again. Whatever else is said about the covenant here in this very impressive covenant scheme. And of course the question is, why this heavy emphasis on the eternal quality of the covenant? When in our earlier discussions of the covenant, relating to earlier texts of the Old Testament, that element didn't seem to be stressed at all. Well, I think you can give the answer yourself. In the darkness of the Babylonian exile, when many were tempted to say, "Let bygone be bygone, this is now a matter of the past. The faith of Israel is at best good for being put on a museum shelf. It's not a present force." They were voices who affirmed, "No, this is not so. What God has begun, that cannot be stopped, that cannot be annulled, even by what has happened to us now in the exile." As one of my teachers said, these theologians, so to speak, want to pull the past with its promises, its covenant affirmations, across the dark abyss, the dark chasm of the exile. Why? In order to sustain their people, in order to comfort their people, or if you want to use Reformation terminology, in order to speak the gospel for this time and place. You may have been faithless. You may have deserved what has come to you. The prophets had already said that. But this does not mean that God gives up on you. In this time and place, when many think it has all come to an end, God's covenant is not eternal, was only for a certain time and place. We affirm that it is eternal. Take comfort in these words. This, I think, was the reason why we hear with such emphasis the phrase the eternal covenant, the covenant forever, the covenant to endless generations. Now let me just say by way of conclusion that we observe in later writings of the Old Testament not in all, as you will learn tomorrow, but in many later writings of the Old Testament, in the intertestamental writings, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, but also in an interesting way in some early Christian writings and early Jewish writings, certainly, this emphasis on the eternal quality of God's covenant. You see, if you stress the eternal quality of God's covenant, you have only one step to go to make it an exclusive affirmation, namely, if God's covenant is eternal and stands forever, by definition, it excludes the possibility of a new covenant. And this is then where the debate begins, more than just the debate. This is the point where ultimately two religious communities part company, the synagogue as the community of the eternal covenant, the church as the community of the new covenant, and stand side by side as two brothers, two sisters, two warring communions, warring with each other. But of that we will speak tomorrow. Let me only quote to you two or three passages from the later Jewish writings. One from Ben Sira. In chapter 45, we hear that this wise man, this late wise man in ancient Israel, writing approximately 200 before Christ, says with emphasis, God of old gave an eternal covenant to Aaron and his priestly house, that they might forever serve the children of Israel. But here it is, very clear in Hebrew, Berit Olam, a covenant forever. Or just yesterday when we read together parts of the Dead Sea Scrolls, we noted that these covenanters that have given us the Dead Sea Scrolls understood themselves as the only true remnant of those who through all generations have kept the eternal covenant. They and they only are the ones who hold on to it, who represent this eternal covenant. Or I should quote to you a writing or a collection of sayings of rabbis roughly from the time of Jesus, it spans actually several centuries, that is well known to scholars of the Bible, called Pirkei Avot. It's not known much beyond the seminary courses, I'm afraid, and that's a pity. Pirkei Avot, P-R-I-Q-E, the Hebrew word for sayings of, and Avot is the Hebrew word for fathers, Sayings of the Fathers is a collection of remarkable sayings of great Jewish teachers, some 200 years before Jesus, and some in the time of Jesus, and some somewhat later, which is well worth studying, by the way, because it illuminates many of the sayings in the New Testament that are of a similar quality, just as many of the sayings in the New Testament illuminate Pirkei Avot. It's required reading, by the way, in my courses and in the courses of some of my New Testament colleagues. Pirkei Avot, not very long, by the way, and found in almost all Jewish prayer books, begins with this statement. Moses received the law of the covenant, at Mount Sinai from God. He passed it on to Joshua, Joshua to the judges to the prophets, and the prophets to the founders of the synagogue. Now you see here the notion of continuity. God, Moses, Joshua, judges, prophets, and the men of the great synagogue, the legendary founders of post-exilic Judaism. You see the notion of continuity that runs through Pirkei Avot 1:1. It's the opening quotation in Pirkei Avot 1:1. And this notion of continuity in its own way also highlights the notion of an eternal covenant. Note how the prophets here become like links in a chain of continuity. Moses, Joshua, Judges, prophets, the men of the great synagogue. The prophets here are primarily oriented toward the past, toward the tradition. They are the ones who are to pass it on and keep it alive. You know that in other Jewish circles, and certainly in early Christian circles, the prophets were understood not primarily as those who relate to the past, but as those who relate the here and now to what is to come, to
to God's coming even. But that already is
what I would like to discuss with you tomorrow. Let it stand. And this is the conclusion of what I would like to say. The emphasis on the eternal quality of the covenant, which we encounter first and with emphasis in exilic texts and then in subsequent texts, is, so to speak, the gospel for the exiles, trying to assure them that what God has begun, he will certainly continue. They may have been faithful, but he continues to be Israel's God forever. The bell has gone. I have gone a little bit longer than I intended to, but I think we have time for one or two questions. Yes, please.
Prior to the exile, then, basically the promises of God, were they tied like to the land and to the temple?
Yes, I think that's fair.
And then the post-exile, they kind of reworked all of that.
Right. They, you see, after the loss of the first tangible tokens of being the covenanted people, the land, they had to make their faith and their covenant understanding portable and no more tie it to something concrete. They didn't have it anymore. And this is one way of coping with it. Yeah, good question. Well, friends, we have gone over time. I invite you back for the third and last of these sessions on the covenant tomorrow.